pick it up now. It's time to move, you look sluggish. You gotta make the bruise, they know your name now. You try to keep you cool, put a moment, pass your momentum, stills in the back.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, friends and comrades. This is Doug Miller here at Amandla Radio with Gwen. We're at home here with Amandla Radio, using the wonders of Zoom to get all these news items that we have about Africa for you on the air. And we hope that you're finding that the material we're providing is giving you insights that you will not find elsewhere. Tonight, I have to commemorate the passing of Paul Farmer, medical doctor and absolute wunderkind of the medical profession in terms of international public health. I'll tell you more about him later on in the show. Gwen, what have you got?
Well, one of my favorite go-to places to read and listen is Africa as a Country. So for those of our listeners who are not familiar with this website, I plead with you, go and kick back and enjoy reading and listening to what they produce. They really are outstanding. And so we're going to be playing a piece produced by them. Back in 2019, South African dairy giant Clover was taken over by Milko, which is a consortium led by Israel's Central Bottling Company. And it's been labor strife ever since. In 2021, the Clover workers in South Africa went on strike against Milko's restructuring campaign. So William Shoki of Africa is a Country podcast talks with Mamet Loué Sebe, who is the president of the General Industries Worker Union of South Africa, one of the unions involved in the strike. And I just wanted to add that Israel's Central Bottling Company also operates in the occupied Palestinian territories. I don't play the second part. Tonight, we're not going to be playing the second part of William Shoki's interview, but he goes on to look at Israel's efforts to acquire accreditation at the African Union and also explores what he describes as a dearth of Palestinian solidarity on the continent. So I encourage you to check out that second half of what he does with this particular piece. And as I said, really just in general, dive in and enjoy it. It's a great site. Africa is a Country.
Welcome back to Africa is a Country Talk. My name is William Shoki, and you are listening to Africa is a Country's weekly talk and interview show. Subscribe to us wherever you listen to your podcasts. Tell us what you think. Give us feedback. We appreciate it all. And importantly, check out africaisacountry.com for new analysis on current affairs on the continent from a left-wing perspective. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter. We're on YouTube. We're on Instagram. Give us a follow. So, on today's program, I'll be playing two interviews that I conducted. The first one is with Mametla Sebe, who is from the General Industries Workers Union of South Africa. And I spoke to him about an ongoing strike that's happening here against a dairy giant called Clover, which was recently taken over by an Israeli company called Central Bottling Company, which also operates in the occupied territories in Palestine. So it's an issue where there is overlap between worker solidarity and Palestinian solidarity. And then I spoke to Naeem Jina from the Afro Middle East Center, which is based here in Johannesburg. And the conversation we had was about the recent maneuvers by Israel to try and get accreditation on the African Union and the various controversies that has sparked, as well as asking how come it is the case that continental solidarity with Palestine is so weak at the moment. So enjoy both interviews. Here they are. Now, if you have been paying attention to happenings in South Africa, you might have noticed that since November of 2021, workers at Clover, which is a popular South African dairy company, have been striking against the organization. The roots of the strike have to do with the 2019 acquisition of clover by an Israeli company called Central Bottling Company and the agenda of austerity that it has been implementing since then. So joining us on the program to talk about the strike further, to understand where things are at, is Mametlo Esabey, who's the president of the General Industries Workers Union of South Africa, as well as a national committee member of the Workers and Socialist Party, which is the South African affiliate of the International Socialist Alternative, which is a revolutionary Marxist organization organizing workers, young people, and socialists in more than 30 countries. Esabey was formerly the national coordinator of the Outsourcing Must Fall movement in 2016, as well as in the 2012 National Mine Workers Strike Committee, and was formerly president of the Pan-Africanist Student Movement of Azania before that. So, Mametlo, thank you so much for coming onto the program.
Thank you, and thank you to your listeners for this opportunity.
So maybe we could just begin by understanding the origins of the strike. Now, this all started in 2019 when CBC, which is the Central Bottling Company, an Israeli firm, took over Clover through a consortium where it was the largest shareholder. This consortium is Milco, and I think the official subsidiary through which it functions in South Africa. So could you tell us a little bit about that takeover and how it happened?
Yes, I mean, that was obviously amongst one of the triggers, and I'll speak about that in a matter of a second, but the causes are much deeper than that. And I think the root cause of it is a deepening crisis of capitalism, the crisis in the economy, which you can see it goes more than a decade, you know, with the Great Recession of 2008, 2009, but also a crisis of climate change, because this company was hit west by the drought that engulfed big part of the country for about 5 years until probably this year and last year, when we have seen a better rain and so on. Now, as you would know, one of the tendencies, you know, of capitalism is that in a period of crisis, there is consolidation of capital. Mm-hmm. And what we see is, of course, big companies taking over smaller companies. And what we are dealing with here is a multinational company, a central bottling company that is Israeli owned, you know, creating a consortium, Melco, with the partners to raid, you know, Clover. I think they paid 4 something billion in that transaction, if I'm not mistaken. And obviously that was linked with a promise of restructuring with a brutal consequences for workers, for their families, for communities, in order to secure a higher rate of profitability. Now, we were always aware that part of the negotiation for takeover was that brutal restructuring and austerity measures for the workers, which was a basis of objection, but also the fact that we are, as workers' movement, committed to the question of Palestine. You know, the issue, the question of working class solidarity is not a sloganeering for us. It's a matter of absolute and vital principle and foundation of our movement. We cannot stand idle when the people of Palestine have been dispossessed of their land, have been displaced from their home, are subjected to a most brutal colonial military occupation over decades without an end. And therefore, we said this company, which is operating on occupied Palestinian territories, that is linked with far-right wing parties that are funding and organizing illegal Jewish settlements on Palestinian land, cannot be allowed to operate here with impunity. And that's the reason that we also objected to this takeover on the basis of working class solidarity and our commitment to international support towards oppressed people of Palestine. Now, government supported the merger. They said this merger is, you know, is part of the investment drive by the president. You know that he announced a target of about 1.4 trillion in investment that he targeted over a period of 5 years. But also they said this is going to create jobs. Now, we presented all evidence of that, that part of the negotiations for the takeover is this package of restructuring. Now, government is going to tell you, or Clover is going to tell you, that they had what you call Project Sincilo, which was a project of restructuring before the merger. But what they will not tell you is that the very reason that they embarked on that process of restructuring was to make Clover, you know, profitable in a way that will attract this sort of investment. And therefore, restructuring, though it preceded the merger, it was very integral to the takeover itself. And that was the basis of objection. We said they're going to destroy jobs. We said they're going to lower conditions of our members. And the government said no such thing is going to happen. In fact, they promised to create about 500 jobs through what they call a Project Masakane. Now, 2 years, all of that, right? Less than 2 years, actually, because the takeover was in October 2019. By now, about over 1,000 jobs were lost. If it was not for the strike, we're looking at 2,000 job losses in this round of restructuring.
And how has Clover tried to rationalize this restructuring? So despite the fact that it came here promising jobs, promising these programs which were supposed to generate those jobs, how's it justifying the restructuring?
Well, their argument is that their competitors, and you know, the biggest of which is a French-owned Parmalat, is operating one mega facility in the country, and they've mentioned others, including I think Dairy Farmers. I think it's a company that we organized, that was actually part of Clover, and it was an entity created by Clover as a way of outmaneuvering what remained of the farmers out of Clover. I mean, what people do not know is that Clover, for about 100 years, it operated as farmers' cooperative. It was taken by corporation, big corporations, only recently. In the past 20 years, they've listed a stock exchange only in the past 10 years. And ever since that time, it has been nothing short of an absolute catastrophe for the workers, for the economy, for many, you know, small towns that are dependent on Clover for their manufacturing. So the way that they are rationalizing is that they've got to cut the cost so that they can be able to compete. Now, when you follow their logic, firstly, Parmalat does not have the same location in the market as Clover, which is well established. It is infrastructure that Parmalat simply does not have. Secondly, is the fact that you know, what they are saying is that they want to reach the wages of Parmalat. Parmalat, I'm told, at least from what we are hearing from Clover, they are paying their workers about 5,400. Now, if we're to allow that race to the bottom, right? They want to cut the wages of our members by 20%. And they are saying even with that cut, they will still be way above those of Parmalat. What it means is that if we allow this 20% cut in wages, they will actually have to hold the wages of our members for years to come in order for Parmalat to catch up. But that is provided that Parmalat does race to catch up, which is not likely, by the way. What Parmalat is going to do is actually going to cut conditions of their workers and vary them downward. And what you are going to end up with, having is a system basically of slavery, where, you know, Parmalat cut down to avoid competition from Clover, and Clover cut down to avoid competition from Parmalat. And what do you end up with? Workers earning 1,500, 2,000, something that is not unheard of in an economy like ours. So this is a typical class book case of a colonial slavery and exploitation that you are seeing from these multinational takeovers and multinational, you know, companies that are raiding South African assets, which I think have been devalued, particularly by the economic crisis, but also the downgrading that we have seen by major credit rating agencies, and they are up for taking. And what government called foreign investment is actually devastation of local industries by big multinationals that aren't creating jobs, that aren't creating factories. If anything, they are decimating what remains of the manufacturing in this country.
That's been a trend recently, right? As you said, government opening our borders to multinational companies to take over local industry, whether it's in supermarkets or alcohol production. Could you talk a little bit more about how this has, especially under the Ramaphosa government, become the vision of development that they're trying to articulate versus what workers are pushing now, which is for inclusive growth, development, bolstering our local manufacturing sector, job creation and the like, and how that's sort of coming at a loggerheads during the strike.
Yeah, we've got to face the fact. I mean, many people in media like playing the fact that these are former trade unionists, right? Now, the trade unionists that we knew in the 80s and that many of us had grown to love at that time and many workers considered their hero, that is long gone and that is long dead. What you have in office today is a billionaire president for the billionaire class in this country. And I think we have got to start from there, that the election of Ramaphosa was further right or shift in that sense, that what the capitalist class seek is their representative, the one of their own, who is clear that what he wants is more, foreign investment-driven growth, that is opening South Africa for business, at a total disregard, flagrant disregard for what protections are there for the workers. That's the reason that we have had, a dismantling of a hard-won labor rights for the workers. The right to strike has been under attack for some time now, and I think that process has been completed under his tenure as a president. And that is indicative that we're not having a former trade unionist in office, we are having a billionaire president. Now, you also, when he took over, he went on a drive for foreign direct investment. Now, the question is, what is he promising them, right? I'm a president of the union because I'm the shop steward at Lawyers for Human Rights, and my day work is actually representing mining-affected communities as lawyers. And I can tell you that what they've done is that they've opened, the country for a colonial-style land dispossession of communities affected by mining. The land dispossession that are reminiscent of a 19th century type of colonialism that we have not seen in more than a century in this country. Now, that is what we are seeing in thing and so on. And I think what is indicative of is the fact that the working class has no party of their own in the ANC. The working class need a party of their own. And that party has to be created by the workers' movement, by communities, and so on, because that is the only instrument that we can forge to make sure that we take power into our own hands, but not just political power. We need economic power. And the only way to go about that is by making sure that we expropriate the capitalists, by nationalizing the banks, the mines, the factories, the farms, and to take those under a democratic control and management of the working class through workers' committees, through representative of communities in the boards of these major corporations, and to make sure that economy and the vast wealth in it is put at the disposal of the working class to resolve the crisis of unemployment, of housing, of public services such as education, health, and to build a much and desperately needed infrastructure in the country, as well as solving all the problems that have left our people in horrendous conditions of life in many of informal settlements, in many rural areas, but also in many black townships in this country.
You spoke just now about part of a program for working class renewal has to be putting firms and corporations under democratic and worker control. That's been one of the demands during the strike. So could you talk a little bit about that demand, how it's envisioned that Clover can be restructured to be controlled by workers, as well as what are some of the other demands that are circulating as workers continue to strike?
Now, we've raised the issue of nationalization of Clover and other democratic, workers' management and control, as you correctly pointed out. And many people have said, well, you are being ideological when there's a very disparate situation. But I think it's important to point how that demand flow from the logic of the crisis in Clover itself, right? We had a meeting with a CEO of Clover, and it was very instructive that he actually drew the same conclusion as ourselves, obviously from a different class point of view. And that was before he was given, a loan of 107 million. And he pointed out that the crisis in Clover, which, as I've said, it has multiple causes, right? The deepening crisis in the economy, because one of the issues that we're not talking about is a deepening poverty of the black working class, which is obviously undermining the market for clover, amongst others. The crisis of climate change, the recurrent drought and other disasters that are obviously hitting a food manufacturing in this country. All of that is the crisis at the root of the problems that we are facing in clover and so on. Now, the point that I think he made is that in this situation, the only investor that will be aligned to our interests, which is to save jobs, which is to save the manufacturing industries, is actually the state. And that he himself has been chasing after the Minister of Trade and Industry. Now, whether that's true or not is immaterial. What is material is the fact that even he recognized that only public ownership in this instance is the only kind of investment that we need to be able to make sure that we maintain the biggest cheese factory at Lichtenberg, that we preserve the jobs that we are having in clover, but also to make sure that we retain the conditions of workers in the state where they are, to be able to improve them over and above that, evading the worst of the restructuring that you're having. And the reason is very simple, right? Mm. Any form of investment that you are having in this period is not investment for the purpose of growth. Capitalists don't invest to create jobs, don't invest to grow the economy. Capitalists invest because they can make profit, right? Now, when the market is flooded because of overproduction and overcapacity, which is a problem in every sector of the economy in this country, but actually across the world as well, right? The crisis that you find in the steel manufacturing, which has seen, biggest steel manufacturer, Highveld Steel, going into business rescue and being taken over by the biggest steel manufacturer, which is ArcelorMittal, which itself, I think, few years ago lost over 96% of their value from 60 billion rand to about 5.6 billion worth in terms of value and so on. And the basis mm-hmm. for that is a dumping of steel from China, which so the price of the ton of steel being worth more than a ton of cabbage in Shanghai Stock Exchange and so on. And I'm just giving an example of what you see insofar as the steel manufacturing. But we have the same situation. I mean, when you see now, you will see that one of the biggest problems is a dumping of cheap imports in the butter markets as mm-hmm. well and so on. So I can go on and on to demonstrate that there is a real crisis. Nobody denies that, right? Less so ourselves. And what we are saying is that what this indicates is that we have a choice between job losses, which have already reached astronomical levels mm. of 12.5 million in the country, the deepening levels of poverty that affects over half of the population, and of course, the fact that the state will have to carry the burden of what you call the working poor. Many of these workers are staying in shacks. When you cut their salaries, what do you say? Because, a shack is the lowest level of housing that we have in this country. Should they stay in caves? Should they go into holes? What alternative do you have? All that you're going to end up having is a situation wherein these workers are prolonging or lengthening the queue for public housing. So instead of prioritizing the unemployed and those people in, a very small companies for housing, you end up now having to subsidize companies, big companies like Clover, in terms of public housing. Some of them, I can tell you this openly, that there are, is fathers who can even acknowledge their own children, paternity of their own children, so that, their wives, their partners can claim social grants to subsidize their cost of living. That is the thing that we have. So the issue of public ownership flow from the logic of the situation and the crisis itself, that any other investor would want to know, how is Clover going to be cutting the cost? And the consequences of it is what is playing out, right? Mm-hmm. In the form of, decimation of industrial capacity in small towns that are already having a very fragile economic base. I mean, what you're going to see, right, in Hebron, in Frankfurt, but also just in that small town that is Lichtenberg. I mean, some of your colleagues have done research there, and I mean, the information is available on the internet if you do search. That shows that it's not just now, you know, the cheese factory that is closing, but because of the closure, a lot of farmers in Lichtenberg are picking up, and when they up their farm, because there's simply no entity that can absorb the gallons of, you know, milk that they produce other than the cheese factory and of course clover there and so on. So the consequences are going to be devastating. So the issue of public ownership emanate from that, but also the issue of workers' control, right? Just on that point, as I summarize, is that you see what is happening in state-owned entities. That public ownership on the basis of capitalism, what does it do? It becomes, you know, a service to big corporations, to entrepreneurs that are accumulating at expense of state-owned entities like Eskom and so on. And therefore, the alternative to that is putting these companies under a democratic control of workers who are interested in the preservation of jobs in their own conditions, as well as making sure that they are able to provide, you know, a cheap dairy products to their communities who are suffering, you know, poverty and hunger in this country. And of course, ensuring that the boards are also representative of those communities. So the issue of nationalization under a democratic control and management flow from the very logic of the case in clover, but the case in the economy as a whole. And that's the reason why we are saying clover can only be the beginning. That needs to be extended to other branches and particularly all the key sectors of the economy so that we are able to have a different economic system with a different planning where all the vast resources in the economy can be harnessed and be put at the disposal of society to resolve all the crises that I've mentioned.
Is the South African government mindful of this? Because you mentioned two important things. One is public ownership, but two, public ownership on the model of democratic workers' control. And as you've been negotiating with them, have they been cognizant of this? Because if we judge from, for example, President Ramaphosa's State of the Nation address, I think two things stand out from that. The first is that pre-existing state-owned enterprises are only going to be further bureaucratized. There was talk of creating holding companies, state-owned holding companies that would be responsible for administering state-owned enterprises. And the second thing is he made further overtures to capital by saying, making this big acknowledgement that a lot of the South African media is just eating up in saying that it's the responsibility of the private sector to generate jobs in this country. So it seems that the trend is moving further and further away from sense, basically, towards this doubling down from the state and capital, away from what you're saying, which is realizing the importance of public ownership. So in negotiations with the Department of Trade and Industry, with representatives from the state, what have they been saying?
No, they've, you know, absolutely stated that they will not nationalize Clover, they will not expropriate it. They don't think that the current legal framework allows them to do that. Now, let me speak to that in a matter of seconds, right? As I said to you, I work, you know, I represent a mining affected community as a lawyer, right? And I can tell you, every time we negotiate for mining affected communities, government is always holding, you know, a threat of expropriation over our head. Now, what does that tell you? This is a government that is prepared to expropriate at the behest of multinationals, people that have been expropriated for 300 years of colonialism in this country, right? And they justify that on the basis of economic development and the need to create jobs. But if that is a criteria, why not do it in a situation of clover that calls out for that, right? Mm-hmm. So what it shows you is that this is a government in the service, right, of imperialism, and by that I mean multinational corporations, but also their South African counterparts as well, right? So ANC is not the friends of the working class. The ANC is not biased towards the working class and so on. The ANC, we must recognize it for what it is the brutal anti-working class party that, for that matter, is drowned in blood, you know, the mine workers in 2012 in defense of this interest. If that is not clarified where their class and political loyalty lies, this speech that was delivered by the president about a few days ago itself has to be another clarification for those that are still unclear. Because what the president at least has done and assisted us is to shed all the pretense of, you know, the whole historical, you know, gibberish that they call a developmental state, right? That the state is going to stay out of the economy, that all that it has to do is to facilitate, you know, private investors to drive the economy and go forward and so on. Now, I have never entertained any illusions on what they call the developmental state. And I think the SACP has always been dishonest. There is no such a form of state, in Marxist science, right? Mm-hmm. States are, you know, class organizations. You either have a bourgeois state and, of course, or, you know, the worker state and so on. And I think what policies government or the state advance at a particular conjuncture is dependent on the interest of the capitalist class. If their interest requires that the state intervene more actively to rescue them, they will do that. And I think I've already, you know, given an example that this is a state that has a power to expropriate communities which are said to be unreasonable in their demands for multinational corporations that are coming on their land, wanting to mine their lands against their will and so on. Look at Kolbeni. Kolbeni. They've effectively expropriated the poor black community that has suffered injustice over decades. How do they justify it? Jobs and the economy. Why the same situation not applying to Clover? God knows, right? So all what it clarifies is a class character of the ANC, is a class character of the state. And all what it clarifies is a need, an urgent and a disparate need for the working class to organize itself politically as well. What we need more than ever before is a mass political party of the working class that can be created and that will be resting on the trade unions and the millions of the members that they organize on community civics. I mean, you look at, you know, every community. There is a form of organization. I mean, there is organizations. Either it's a community forum, crisis committee, a local shutdown committee, which personify, or if you like, reflect the permanent state of revolt of working class communities, at their conditions, particularly lack of service delivery, jobs, and all of that and so on. But also young people that particularly since 2015 in that, you know, marvelous movement that was a Fist Must Fall and so on, have been, you know, organized, have been up in arms. And of course, that is also an important contingent that we must bring, as well as other movements that are responding, you know, to crisis of climate change, to explosion in gender-based violence and other. We must bring all of that under one umbrella. Of course, we have got to rebuild our mass organizations, but part of rebuilding those mass organizations is making sure that we put a program that can unite all of these struggles, struggles in communities, struggles in workplaces, in campuses, struggles against climate change, against gender-based violence, against xenophobia, against all of that under one umbrella. But for a class to have a program in terms of how society should be run, it also has to take its leadership of society. And the only vehicle that historically has been forged is a vehicle of a mass, I mean, of a political party. And that's the reason that we're saying what the situation requires is a mass political party of the working class on a socialist program to ensure that not only do we elevate the working class to political power, but by that socialist program, we're able to take the commanding heights of the economy and ensure that the economy is spent in the interest of the working class and poor majority in this country.
So you've just been listening to an interview by William Shoki of Africa as a Country podcast in conversation with Mametwe Sebe, who is the president of the General Industry Workers Union of South Africa. You're listening to Amandla here on CQT 90.3 FM.
On rebuilding mass organizations in South Africa, the trade union movement has been on a decline globally. Do you think that this strike can serve as a catalyst for galvanizing the trade union movement? And have you noticed, for example, in your organizing of clover workers with Kiwusa, and from what you've seen from the activities of FAWU, is this something that is helping not only reach out to workers who are affected by the restructuring of Clover, but beyond in the food and manufacturing sector and other sectors of society. I think one interesting aspect of this mobilization is also the way in which it can forge worker and consumer solidarity. So in terms of uniting work and community struggles, this is something that you can also appeal to members of the community and say, boycott Clover, on top of other activities that you can take to pressurize the company to seize what it's doing. So do you think that this is, I think, as arguably the most, the most significant protest action that South Africa has witnessed in the last couple of years? Do you think this is going to form a galvanization of the trade union movement?
It is, and it has already done that. Because just think about it, right? When did you last have a coordinated international day of action in support of the movement in South Africa since the collapse of apartheid? I was there at Marikana. I was there in the mine workers' strike. We didn't have, the amount of coordinated international solidarity that we have received. I mean, on that day of international day of action against Clover, we had people protesting in three U.S. cities, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and New York. With comrades protesting at Sao Paulo in Brazil, in Sweden, in Belgium, three protests, London, Leicester, and I can't remember the other in UK, with comrades protesting in Nigeria and number of countries across the world. Canada, you mentioned all of them, right? Mm. So what it has revived is, traditions of international solidarity in a way that South African workers' movement has not been party to in a very long time, that we are beginning to lose. And I think that's very important, that we've taken the issue of Palestine in a way that, because one of the tragic features of our movement is that we've become so accustomed to receiving solidarity and not giving it, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that Clover is probably the biggest pro-Palestinian movement happening in the world at the present moment, for me, is a complete vindication of our stance and our protest and our position on the takeover of Milko, but also vindication of a tradition, a proud tradition of working class solidarity. That slogan of an injury to one is an injury to all. And that was never a slogan that meant just an injury to South African workers. It was always an injury to a worker everywhere, right? So the oppressed people of Palestine are us, and we're them. That's the way that we see it, right? But also, when did you ever have a strike that has had, the movement uniting across the spectrum? We are having a support not only of all the unions in SAFTU that have mobilized for the strike. Of course, more could always be done, but I think we've seen them in action during that day of action with NUMSA, with TAU, with KASAVU, but also not just that. We are having COSATU now, not only having the statement, but also being part of our war room. I can tell you, since the formation of SAFTU, we have not had COSATU and them sitting in a way that they've said, in the way that they're participating in joint planning, council for the purpose of taking this strike forward. And I'm in my discussions with comrades in NACTU and other federations, is that there's a willingness. So this strike has already begun to achieve unity in a way that no any other movement has done, right? We've also seen, secondary actions that we have not seen before. The workers, I think, is a dairy company organized by KASAVU, the affiliate of farm workers of SAFTU. I just forget the name of that company. It's very important. I think we should be able to name it. Workers took an action, and as a result, the company was forced to cancel a contract with Clover, which wanted to outsource the production to them, and especially for the purpose and during the course of the strike. We've also seen unprecedented, working class community solidarity in a way that we have not seen in a long time, right? I day in, day out, I receive footages of people chasing, you know, clover marketing groups out of their community, a rural community. Clover people were there to advertise their project, and they said, no, you are not welcome here. We are in support of striking clover workers and so on. And just individuals, just, you know, progressive people that have taken the stance, the unprecedented support that we have had. I mean, food parcels have been flowing here in Devon, in Western Cape, across the country. We've just been receiving that and so on. Number of, you know, food chains, I mean, you know, retail stores have refused to stock, you know, clover products. Some voluntarily out of solidarity with clover workers, some because of an intense pressure of their own local communities. Clover brought multiple court actions to try to stop hashtag boycott clover campaign. That is how, you know, intense the pressure of that campaign is. And that speaks to an overwhelming working class solidarity and support that has taken a much more active form in a way that I think I cannot recall any strike receiving in recent times. So I think this strike for me is groundbreaking. It's also a demonstration more than all that we can fight back. And when we fight, we can't be able to stop the capitalists, because what is it that we have already achieved?
Exactly.
In Clover itself, right? In Clover itself, I mean, in August, the company sent us a notice of retrenchment at City Deep. They were saying that jobs of about 824 workers were on the line. Now, they are denying that they have changed, but I'll explain that in a second. But what they've done is that they want to replace City Deep with the Atlas, a new factory at Atlas in Boksburg. What is happening with that factory is that over 90% of the workers there are labor broking. What is very clear, they wanted to replace, you know, a permanent full-time workers that are unionized with labor broking precarious and non-unionized labor, right? All of that has fell flat. The notice that they've sent was saying 824 workers are likely to be rendered redundant. Now, having postponed the matter and realizing that they blundered, because we wanted to bring all the dispute under one umbrella, they now withdrew that notice. When they returned the notice in February, the notice was saying only 9 workers will be affected. Now that's, you know, is a major victory and a concession. As I'm talking to you now, again, they've offered to reinstate all those workers that were dismissed, but they are also offering to pay their full salaries at least for 8 months. We are rejecting that. And of course, you are saying that we can only review negotiation wages for the whole duration of, I mean, at the end of the collective agreement, which if it's going to be 2 years, it must be 2 years for all the workers, right? So, and that has already inspired, you know, because this strike has concentrated the minds of all classes, by the way. You know, the BGS of SAFTU made a point, I'm told during the presentation, that what Clover has already done is what the Clover strike has done effectively is to put moratorium on retrenchments across the country. Many companies, I know that they wanted to retrench, all of them are holding back, looking at the outcome of what comes out of Clover. Because what we achieve at Clover is going to be a benchmark for the workers and for the bosses. If we win against the retrenchments, against the factory closures, no any other worker would accept that. Right? If we lose, it will be a disaster for the whole movement. It will, if you like, be condoning the capitalists to carry on as they've done in the past decades, where the whole burden of the economic crisis and now of COVID is being offloaded on the shoulders of the workers and the working class people in general. So I think we've drawn the line sharply on the scent. We've taken a stand. And I think this is a fight that every working class and progressive person in this country and across the world must support, because what we achieve here is going to have repercussions for the movement at large in this country. And I suspect many other people across the world will be inspired by the fight. And of course, if we are defeated, they'll be demoralized equally.
So what comes next? What confrontations can we expect? And how can regular people support and participate in this? I think victory will be ours, but how can we mobilize and where can people go in order to do their part in order to ensure that victory can be ours?
Yes, victory is far from secure. There's a lot of things that we still need to fight around, right? Mm. As I said, Clover is not offering full wages of those workers for the whole duration of 2 years and permanently. They are saying that they would cut them by 20% after 8 months. Now, we can't accept that, right? There are factories that are closing across the country and so on. I think my view is that those factories need to be occupied, right? They need to be occupied, and we are able then to launch a campaign against the background of that occupation to say government must take them over, but also we must demand that Clover itself, which, by the way, has, against the background of the strike, agreed to hand over those factories to government and the workers. But it must invest enough money because they are saying that they were saying they are offering 10 million. Yeah. Now they said 50 million. But we require investment on the scale of hundreds of millions, if not billions, to recapitalize those particular factories and ensure that we retain the manufacturing capacities in those particular towns and so on. So I think, community activists need to come and support the workers on the picket lines in Clayville, in PE, in Western Cape, Milnerton, but also in Lichtenberg and in Bulukwane and other areas where there are similar demonstrations, Sip Deep and all of that. We need, communities to continue pressurizing their local retailers not to stock, Clover products. And where they can, of course, to be able to, put the, leaflets and others to educate public that these are products of scape labor, a labor that is employed to defeat the legitimate demands of the workers against job losses, against factory closures, and of course, for decent minimum wages in terms of conditions of employment that are under attack with a 20% wage cuts and other brutal restructuring measures that are taking place, including reduction of van assistance from 2 to 1, which would mean that a worker basically that is driving the van from 7 o'clock in the morning all the way to Limpopo until late afternoon will have to, in addition to driving, have to be loading off the merchandise because we'll only be having one assistant instead of two. And I can go on and on about other measures that they wanted to implement. A flexible labor, by which they mean that, a driver can be made to clean, can be made to do security duties, a compulsory work on public holidays and Sunday. So what Clover want to introduce is a most brutal form of slavery that we have not seen, at least since the end of apartheid. And I think we have to hold them on their tracks. And I think so far the strike has done that on some issues, but we need more solidarity. We need more community activists on the picket lines. We need more community activists going to the malls, going to the retailers, and of course, making sure that boycott Clover is intensified, but also we need donations. Lenin says that money is a symbol of war. Napoleon says the army marched on his stomach. So we need that to be able to keep the workers on strike, on picket lines. And I think every donation, and we've published our banking details, comrades can find them on our, Facebook pages, on our, other media platforms. But we are saying that every cent count, because it's not just about the quantity, it's about the quality of sacrifice. Every worker, every community activist, every progressive person who donate what cents and rents, they count, because they tell us that we're not alone and we are having people in this country that are supporting us.
Well, to our listeners, you've heard the clarion call. We will share those links to donate, those links to get involved on our social media channels as well. And you've heard the message, boycott Clover, make sure it's not in your fridge, make sure it's not in your cupboards. Mametre, thank you so much for coming onto the program.
Thank you very much. And thank you very much for your solidarity and support and, your listeners as well.
If you've not been, if just a reminder that I've been talking to Mametlwe Sebei, who is the president of the General Industries Workers Union of South Africa, as well as a national committee member of the Workers and Socialist Party. Thanks again, Mametlwe, and keep well and good luck. We'll be supporting you in whatever way we can, as well as all of the striking workers.
Thank you, and pleasure being here.
Everyone should have access to equal quality healthcare, but for millions around the world, that's not the reality. 50% of people across the globe lack access to essential hair care. As many of our listeners know, I have a deep and very personal relationship with my wife's family village in Malawi. With a number of dear friends, we have worked to bring clean water, better schools, and better living conditions. However, from our very first activities in 2008, the mothers of Makupo Village and other stakeholders in nearby Chilanga and Kaumba repeated their need for a chipatala, a hospital. At first we resisted because of the enormity of the task, but in 2012, one of our dear Makupo mothers lost a child to malaria, completely avoidable because she didn't have the money or transport or whatever other source to solve a problem that easily could have been dealt with. We finally felt compelled to help and build a clinic, and that same year we began our planning. One of our inspirations came from the solidarity, not charity, approach of an organization called Partners in Health, PIH.org, co-founded by Dr. Paul Farmer. Dr. Paul Farmer died on Monday in Rwanda at the hospital and university that he and his organization had set up there. He was lecturing at the university and continuing his extension work to make health delivery available and equal to everyone in the world. He was 62 and was taken by an unexpected heart condition. Like us, he was both furious and frustrated that anybody poor should not be able to have equal quality health care, equal to that of the richest person on the planet, and he made it his mission to correct this evident injustice. In fact, one of his organization's slogan is "Injustice has a cure." Starting in the late 80s, as a young medical resident, he describes in his interview with Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman how he developed his concept of holistic public health care that began to produce better health outcomes in the regions he served than exists in most of the United States. This is a short clip of her obituary to him. It is well worth going to Democracy Now! To hear his full presentation.
This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we spend the rest of the hour remembering Dr. Paul Farmer. The world-renowned infectious disease doctor and medical anthropologist died unexpectedly Monday at the age of 62 in Rwanda on the grounds of a hospital and university he helped establish there. Paul Farmer was a professor at Harvard Medical School, co-founder of Partners in Health. As a medical student in 1987, he co-founded the group to deliver free, quality health care to people in Haiti. Over time, the group grew into an international network serving millions of patients in many of the poorest parts of the world. Dr. Farmer tirelessly fought for his patients to receive the same access to life-saving drugs as patients in wealthy countries. Dr. Paul Farmer once said, "The idea that some lives matter less is the root of all that is wrong with the world." Farmer's work helped change how health care was delivered throughout the world. Partners in Health CEO Sheila Davis said in a statement, quote, "Paul Farmer's loss is devastating, but his vision for the world will live on through Partners in Health. Paul taught all those around him the power of accompaniment, love for one another, and solidarity." The writer Tracy Kidder wrote about Farmer's work in his 2003 book, Mountains Beyond Mountains, The Quest of Dr. Paul Farmer, A Man Who Would Cure the World. Paul Farmer appeared on Democracy Now! Numerous times over the last 20 years. Later in the show, we'll speak with one of his longtime colleagues at Partner in Health. But first, let's turn to Paul in his own words, speaking in 2008 on Democracy Now! About his early work in Haiti.
Well, you know, it was, for me, an epiphany to go 25 years ago to go to Haiti. And I was lucky enough to end up in a squatter settlement of, of peasants who'd lost their land to a hydroelectric dam. So the choices were very stark. You know, either health was a commodity that was bought and sold, or the people that I went there to serve as a naive but well-meaning young person were out of the picture. And so, you know, that began a lifelong fascination with rights, not just to the right to vote or other civil and political rights, but also the right to eat and the right to have access to health care.
Talk about how you decided on this place called Kanj in central Haiti, how you found it, how you began to build the hospital system you have there.
As is often the case, and I try to encourage students, I teach students, so I tell them, look, you never know what's going to happen. And it was really a series of serendipitous accidents. I met a Haitian priest, and he was working in a nearby town, and he told me about this squatter settlement where people were living in lean-tos, and he was focused on education and said, look, you're going to be a doctor. Why don't you come and be part of this? And so that was 25 years ago. We started with a small group of young people my age going from village to village, asking people in their homes, so what is it you would see as an appropriate healthcare system? And some people kind of laughed at us, saying, well, what do you, you know, and a little bit archly, well, what do you think, you know? And they would usually say, though, a hospital. We want a hospital. And we had in mind, you know, a system of a small community health clinic and a system of satellite system. And they wanted a hospital. They wanted a good hospital. A hospital, someone said to me in 1984, where if you have trouble having a baby, you could actually have someone save your life. I knew just what that meant, of course. And sure, you know, over the years, with a lot of help from people, mostly in Haiti, but in North America, we built a hospital. It's a big hospital now.
Primarily treating what?
Well, you know, we primarily do not treat infectious disease, although I think we have a reputation of taking on AIDS, TB, malaria. But we treat whatever comes in, a broken arm, obstructed labor, and, you know, the things that you see out in the rural countryside in Africa or Haiti. And but in the mid-90s, I must say, just shortly after we built the hospital in a very difficult time during a coup. Those were very hard years, 91 to 94. You were already involved in reporting on that. But we did get the hospital done. And by the mid-90s, we once looked to see, okay, how many people in this hospital have AIDS or HIV infection? And it was up to 40% at one point. So we said at that time, I was going between Harvard and Haiti. I was being trained as an infectious disease specialist at Harvard, and, you know, it's right around the corner to Haiti. So I'd get off the plane on one side, and I'd be begging my American patients, you've got to take these pills, these, you know, AIDS cocktails. And I'd get off on the other side, and they'd be begging me for the same medicines. So we spent a couple of years saying there's got to be a way to deliver the same services to people living in Haiti. And, you know, it took a long time to get that support. We started in 1998, and we actually called it somewhat sassily the HIV Equity Program, because we knew it would be a fight for equity from the beginning, and we knew it would be a fight for basic rights as well.
So that wraps it up for us here on Amandla. We were just informed by the folks at CKUT that we're very quickly heading into fundraising at the station. And while we have not physically been present in the studio since the pandemic, and we miss it enormously, we've still got all the support from the station. They have continued to be wonderful, tiny skeleton staff working out of there, making sure that things are still running and that we get on the air every week. So we're moving into fundraising mode. And please, if you like what you're here and you're committed to community radio, think about loosening up the purse strings for CKUT. You can just go online at ckut.ca. Pop a donation, mention Amandla if you please, and it would be greatly, greatly appreciated. We'll be back next week. Stay tuned now for Jazz Euphoria.
Oshiega 2022, Montreal's beloved outdoor festival, announces its full lineup. Let us know your favorite act to be entered into a draw for a pair of three-day passes. Comment on social media or call the studio line at 514-448-4013 and leave a message to be entered into the draw. we will be drawing three names. Enter before Friday, February 25th at 5 p.m. to win.
Productions Nuit d'Afrique and TD Bank Group are proud to present the New Faces of Afro Jazz, a special evening of concerts offering us a musical journey to Cuba, Ivory Coast, and Guadeloupe with Deme Arosena, Donald Dogbo, and Tobium. Broadcast live on the Nuit d'Afrique Facebook page Thursday, February 24th at 8 p.m. More info at productionsnuitdafrique.com.
Oshiega 2022, Montreal's beloved outdoor festival, announces its full lineup. Let us know your favorite act to be entered into a draw for a pair of three-day passes. Comment on social media or call the studio line at 514-448-4013 and leave a message to be entered into the draw. We will be drawing three names. Enter before Friday, February 25th at 5 p.m. to win.
En présence de symptômes de la COVID-19, comme la toux, la fièvre, le mal de gorge, la perte du goût ou de l'odorat, isolez-vous et faites un test rapide à la maison. Pour en savoir plus et connaître les consignes d'isolement à respecter pour vous et ceux qui vivent avec vous selon votre résultat de test rapide, consultez québec.ca/isolement. On continue de se protéger. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.